earlier that we can run to the airport, you know, avoid the traffic before it gets hectic. All right. Colleagues, that was the marathon presentation. It's up to us now to engage with the input. And the table is open. There's still a little bit of settling in. Let's allow Professor Ndabandaba and Honorable Steele to. Okay. All right. AG, you wanted to break the ice for us.
Yes, Chair. Just to say that in the same vein that the funding model was significantly important for SCOET, because there's the rates for our office will need to be approved by SCOET in terms of the charter rates and the table. At the time of bringing the strategic plan for this one as well, the directives for the audit standards that needs to be used for the entire public sector will also require SCOET approval, all of which are required in terms of the Public Audit Act. So that's the significance of these two presentations today. They've got a specific statutory requirement for SCOEC to deal with in terms of the Public Audit Act. Yeah. I suppose the only area that is not well defined would be in terms of this last presentation, the role that SCOEC plays in influencing the right results for government. I suppose that's still an open-ended debate, as we discussed in the first day's slides. That as an office, we have started on this on the leadership visibility campaign, and if SCOET can complement that, I think that will help to get government towards clean reports, which will do us good as a country. But the more critical one is the fact that when we come back in October, the approval of the standards will be required from SCOET.
Let me just say that, first of all, in relation to us going out in the field, we have scheduled provincial visits for when? For the week of? 16th of October. All right. We'll obviously revisit the dates, but just the principle of it. We have felt that it's not good enough for us to sit here in Cape Town and go through the report, but that we do need to make our own turn at where the action is. This is some of the municipalities that are challenged, an issue that's often talked about, and interact with them to understand from their point of view what the challenges on the ground really are. I've heard, for example, that, sorry, my phone is on. Can I come back to you? I'm in a meeting. Send me an SMS. Thank you. Right, it's off. Yeah, where was I? Provincial visits, yeah. So I think we may want to maybe pick one municipality which is doing well, and just to get to understand what is it that a municipality does as a recipe for success. But then concentrate more on the municipalities that are not doing so well in order to understand their side of the story as to what kind of challenges. I'm still saying that one of the challenges that I seem to hear in relation to municipalities that are struggling. It's the capacity first to collect revenue in the form of municipal taxes and so on from residents on the one hand, and the capacity of residents or certain communities to afford paying for services, especially municipalities which are largely in impoverished rural communities. I don't know to what extent that is a significant factor in the defaults that we experience, but obviously we'll get to hear more about that. Hopefully, if we could have the visit preceded by a briefing with the Department of Provincial Local Government, they have a new name now, Corporate Traditional Affairs, Corporate Governance and Traditional Affairs. Also, in relation to the other matter, we said we needed to come back to what was it? Well, we said that they would need to be present as well. Yes. So they tell us, you know, what their observation as the department that's responsible for assisting with capacity there is, so that when we go there, we know what it is we're going to look for and what we're going to. All right. The floor is open. Honorable Ndabandaba, Prof.
Thank you, Chair. I've got two questions of clarity. The first one is, where do we draw the line between mandatory and discretionary audits? It's a layman's question. And the second one is, how was your audit training received by the media? Has it borne any fruit so far? That's all I want to find out.
The visitor, you have, for now you're fine. All right. Anybody else? Phil, George? Yeah. Honorable Sosibo.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, there was an example that we were given by the AG of the leakage of the information that resulted in a judge having said something. I would like to know, how did you explain to the judge the leakage? And how did you solve that problem?
Maybe for now, let's take that round and see how it goes.
I think in terms of the mandatory versus discretionary audits and where we draw the line, The response to that is that maybe let's start with the mandatory audits, because those, there's no line to be drawn. We've got to do them every year. They're part of the PFMA, they're part of the, I suppose, even the constitution to audit and report. And in that respect, we've got to then follow the trend of the finance management legislation in terms of the regularity of reporting. So insofar as the regularity audits are concerned, they are part of our annual responsibility. The only area that we have delayed in terms of the mandatory audits is the service delivery audits, what was referred to as the audit of performance information. It is captured in the Public Audit Act that we will also do that annually. But in consideration of the fact that government is not as yet ready for this type of audit, That's why we have introduced an extended phasing in period and an education period and a readiness intervention by Treasury to make sure that at the point we start expressing an opinion on this audit, there are no embarrassments for government, there are no misunderstandings of expectations. And in fact, in this year's roadshows in the general report, we'll be putting a lot of emphasis on our assessment of the extent of government readiness to be audited and for us to express an opinion in this respect. Yeah. So we are now close to now executing all the mandatory audits and expressing opinion on them within the, let's say, the next 18 to 24 months. With regard to the discretionary audits, these are the ones that will fall into the category of performance audits. And I would imagine that's the most important one, because that one does not necessarily come about on the basis of a request, but generally it would come about on the basis of what we consider to be in the interest of the public. And that's a very difficult judgment call to make. And for us, it requires a wide consultation to establish the extent to which and the coverage and the topics that would be suitable to conduct these performance audits. Our approach for that one has been premised on the criteria that we have established to choose those topics. We did not go through that criteria today, but within the office we have established a committee that the special audit wing of the office briefs myself and the Deputy Auditor General on the assessment of all those criteria. And for that, we look at a whole range of issues, starting from the President's State of the Nation Address to the feedback that we get from the various stakeholders, being the parliamentary committees, be it the cabinet, be it our own assessment of the issues. So there's a wide range of consultation that we do to establish these topics. SCOWEC will naturally be one of the stakeholders to consult, and SCOPUS, public accounts committees, in determining these topics. Up to now, we haven't been too close in terms of our consultation with the various stakeholders, because the kind of performance audit we've been doing were based on the requests that, to a large extent, were made by the departments. But we've departed from that approach now. We want to look at things from a holistic perspective and say, out of these national priorities, which ones will serve the country best if we perform these performance audits, which essentially, as Jan said, look at the effective utilization of government resources. So they will be done on a cyclical basis, not too often, but when they're done, we need to make sure that we get the best value for those audits. Up to now, without having done a lot of consultation, but we'll do that in future, we have chosen three topics of which we are close to commencing with one of them, and we're already in the progress, in process with the other. We've chosen the topic of the use of consultants by government departments, because the nature of these audits is such that we would look at the entire public service, from national government to provincial government to local government, and to some extent even the public entities. We felt that topic was important because of the constant reports that were issued in our general report around the vacancy levels in the government and large sums of money that are paid to consultants. So we felt it was important to evaluate the extent to which these consultants are necessary and to what extent are they not necessary. Where they are necessary, to what extent are they of valuable support to government as opposed to just being paid the money and leave no value for government. So I think it's going to be a very useful audit once we finalize it. At the time, I'm not even quite sure, Jimmy, when that will be finalized. The second one, which you said was important, was the audit of the governance arrangement around public entities. Because even though we may not be auditing all the public entities, some of them are audited by the private firms, we came to the realization that the public entities are a very essential machinery for delivering services and delivering service delivery for government, on behalf of government. Them being a government machinery anyway, because they're funded by government. But you find that the ministry, and in South Africa, there are various ministries that are in charge of public entities. And if you look at face value at the treatment and the approach to dealing with these public entities, it's widely inconsistent. So we wanted to understand what governance arrangement, in spite of knowing that there are compact arrangements between the public entity and the ministry, but the application of those compacts, to what extent, first and foremost, do they exist, and where do they do exist? Do the ministries have the capacity to monitor service delivery mandates for these public entities and manage it effectively? So it's another report that we think is holistic enough to give us a sense of whether government investments and resources are put into good use. The last one that we've identified thus far is on education. This is a very complicated one because education is very open-ended, and the priorities for education are highly contested in terms of what philosophical arrangement holds water in relation to the other. But for that one, we have not chosen or anchored the exact theme that we're going to be honing onto. We intend to wait until the outcomes and the priorities for education have been defined by the fourth administration. Because here we run the risk of choosing a topic only to find that we're going in a total tangent with the government priorities. So our approach is to wait for that to be defined. Once that's defined, then we can look at the processes that will enable the achievement of those priorities from the effective use of whatever resources are plowed into education. So that's the broad arrangement in terms of the topics that have been chosen thus far. But going into the future, there are many aspects of priority to government. We'll be consulting quite widely in determining these topics. Yeah. The other discretionary audit will obviously come as part of a request if there's a request for an investigation or a request for an agreed-upon procedure. But I think the more critical ones are the regularity and performance audits. So far we have because I think this is also important because it should be contained in our strategic plan. Up to now we've spent up to less than 10% of our resources on performance audits. The bulk of our resources are currently allocated to regularity audits. Now, I think the drawing of the line question is important in this respect. What's the ideal ratio for that split between the performance audit and regularity audit? And it's a moving target for us because the criteria for determining what the ideal ratio should be, to a large extent, will be the extent to which government moves quickly to dealing with and resolving the basic challenges that exist around regularity audit. And we do think that at the point where we're talking about clean audits in South Africa, we can start scaling down on the resources that are plowed into regulatory audit and start now looking at now the issue of utilization of resources. I think it will be a a rather ill-advised approach to take shortcuts on regularity audits when we know that the basics are not yet in place and jump into an elevated audit coverage when we know that the answers are going to take us back anyway to those basics that we're still picking up on the regularity audit. So it's a bit of a difficult balance against the expectations of stakeholders that we should move quickly towards performance audits. And I suppose it's a debate that within SCOWEC we'll still continue to have every year. Yeah. Now, with regard to the impact of the media education, it has been very effective. We, in fact, have been to almost every media house in South Africa, and I think almost all of them we've covered. And with all of them, they have actually found this presentation to be so valuable, because when we started visiting the media houses on a courtesy basis to introduce ourselves and to highlight the importance of them understanding our work, this was the request from the media houses, that you need to actually take us through your process so that we can have a better understanding thereof. And that's what triggered this the putting together of this presentation. And I must say, up to now, there are very few instances where we are misquoted by the media. So those instances, like the one I'm going to respond to in terms of the judgment around the e-natives, we've never had such an instance since, after having had these presentations, including the BLT. I mean, we had a specific presentation with that media house. There was appreciation of this process, after our engagement with them. But obviously, we can't reverse that judgment. We're not the respondents in that case. It was the Department of Transport that was the respondent. So we did not participate in the process. Yeah.
What is the essence of the decision there? The court judgment.
Sure. If you recall the issue of the e-natives saga last year or 2 years ago, where there was a report that was leaked into the media around the malfunctioning of the e-native system, which had resulted in the collapse of the motor vehicle registration system throughout the country. We had done an audit in that area, computer audit, but before the report had reached a final stage of conclusion, the management report, which was still subject to a review and response and action by the department, leaked into the media. Now, the issue there was that there was contestation on the validity of that reporting, which was legitimate, because that report, had not even come to myself. It was a management report which was still being reported, responded to by the department. But the newspaper or the media house went into court, high court, to seek judgment to validate their action around the releasing of that report in the media, because the department was contesting that. But the judgment went against the department and supported the media house in terms of the, the right to transparency, etc., etc. But I think the point they missed, the judge, was the fact that that judgment was premised on information that ought not to have been in the public space. But because of not understanding the process that we talk about, the judge did not get that insight quite convincingly. That's the essence of the issue here. So we're sitting with a judgment that has set a precedence, and I suppose we need to find a way of making sure that it does not repeat itself. But we have managed it ourselves by educating the media, because the source of that risk would emerge in future from the media houses. Yeah.
The issue of access to information is, and the management of that will be a constant area of contestation. I participated in the committee that passed the Promotion of Access to Information Act, and Yeah, it wasn't an easy task with all the exemptions we had to put in place and so on and so on. But I think all legislation needs to be tested from time to time. And if there are reasons to revisit legislation, of course that's underpinned by constitutional right. And if legislation over-restricts the constitutional right, the courts can always, overturn even the legislation itself. So that's the other thing. But yeah, if we encounter such issues, we need to reflect on them and see what the legislation is providing a sufficient balance between the right to know on the one hand, in this instance, and the importance of making sure that we do not distort things through media releases that would have a damaging effect on the effective functionality of certain institutions and certain processes. I had Mr. Steele.
Yes, thank you, Chair. I just wanted to welcome the AG's assurance that we will be discussing in SCOAG the discretionary audits. I think that's a very valuable part of the consultation. And I look forward to that kind of dialogue around where the priorities for these discretionary audits should lie. So I just thank the AG for that.
Who else wanted to raise an issue? Yeah. There's one or two points that I wanted to raise. First of all, in terms of the performance audits, which as I understand, it's the next step that you are at this stage doing the necessary planning and consultation with government around. I suppose that would necessarily link in with the new ministries that have been established in the economic cluster, planning, monitoring and evaluation. The name of Minister Chabani was branded from time to time this morning, suggesting, I suppose, that there are consultations that are happening between the AG's office and that ministry around defining the parameters of the kind of new oversight models that are going to be laid out to evaluate performance. He likes to give the example of health, where you have some official sitting somewhere with very little understanding of how medical processes work, and leaving an urgent requisition for the dispensing of medicines lying for 2 weeks, and during that 2 week period, a whole batch of medicine prescribes and becomes obsolete. By the time the medicines are finally dispatched, all that can be done is to throw them in the dustbin. Some such challenges. Having the right levels of skills at the right places, having the right procedures, having the right levels of decision making. From a controls point of view, but also from a point of view of expediency and making sure that the delivery system is not unnecessarily clogged by something which you could call, by bureaucracy. I've had the experience 2 weeks ago, or was it last week, where I met this consultant who's supposed to move around different provinces, setting up certain information systems. Now, when he is supposed to, when he came to Cape Town to do his job, the manager in Cape Town had gone to a workshop, an important training workshop in George, and apparently when the manager is away, his office is locked. So they couldn't access certain equipment which had been shipped down to enable the consultant to set up the system. So he traveled all the way to Cape Town and had to travel back to Johannesburg, in fact, to move to the next province because his program, his schedule did not coincide with the schedule of the manager at the office. And he asked the question, what happens if there's a fire? Because seemingly nobody is allowed or has access to the keys to the manager's office. So there's crazy things that you hear of. The rationale seems to have been that the manager's office has very security, high security sensitive things, and therefore you need to control access strictly. So there is a rationale behind it, but at the same time, there is the unintended consequence where you can basically clog the system in the interest of trying to protect the security. So finding the right balance sometimes can be a challenge. But in the meantime, I'm just giving that as one of the many situations where the net effect becomes elements of inefficiency. I don't know how the Auditor General in such situations, how he judges the situation, because sometimes you find that there are competing interests or priorities, and you know, you're not sure where to put emphasis, you know. Say in this case between speedy service delivery on the one hand and maintaining integrity of the system. A quick other example, I come from the social development sector where you are constantly trying to push for more people to have access to the benefit, to have people receive their benefit quicker. But in the process, you have people who, you know, have a lot of forged identity documents, and you're trying to filter the system from some such elements, but in the process you may slow down service delivery. Where do you draw the line? Where do you put your priority when there are competing or conflicting interests? Usually conflicting, not necessarily. I mean, usually competing, not necessarily conflicting interests. So that's just the one point when it comes to performance that one would want to know how you're going to deal with some of those nuances. The link to that is the issue of interpretation of statutory instruments and other prescripts in terms of which or which define the mandate. I know public servants have the tendency to rather sit and do nothing unless they are sure that what they are doing is in accordance with the prescripts, because the latter, because if you proceed and then you're found to be, you know, in violation of prescripts, the AG will be on your head. So nobody wants to be hauled on the red carpet of SCOPA, so they'd rather sit and do nothing. How do you manage some of those challenges?
Why do I ask those this difficult question? That's right, yeah. But you know, the points you're raising are very valid. And for us, we've got a very practical approach to it. I mean, as auditors, we do not and we're not supposed to restrict anyone from executing their job in pursuance of service delivery. And like in any business, pursuit of service delivery, pursuit of organizational objectives has got to be done within the parameters of clean and good governance. because a free-for-all situation that has got no checks and balances breeds a lot of undesirable results, which are all known in terms of corruption, in terms of preferential treatment, unfair, and otherwise. And it's for this reason that we say, in doing all these service delivery priorities, the establishment of appropriate controls is what needs to be done. And it's for this reason that one of our vocal recommendations and points of communication is about the strengthening of internal audit, particularly in this day and age when we are now about to pronounce on the service delivery credibility. The proactive approach to auditing can only be done if internal auditors are there to be a source of wisdom to departments in doing things within the right parameters. And my understanding of internal audit is that it does not restrict anyone from doing their job, but it just makes sure that it gives you sufficient advice and guidance as to how to do it within the required prescripts. Now, anyone who then resists pursuing service delivery because they're scared of auditors, I think that person is not doing his or her job. That's where leadership, once again, becomes an important imperative. Because if leadership is not doing their own monitoring, people will always have this tendency of not doing their job because no one is monitoring them anyway. And in this respect, it's for this reason, once again, that we say regular reporting to leadership about department's priorities is an imperative, and the risks to service delivery is an imperative. You know. And here, I think my words are very clear that we're not saying transgression of prescripts is an issue, but the risk to service delivery. That's the priority of internal auditors. And that's the mindset as we go around to these departments, as we go around to municipalities, we're making clearly understandable to the leadership that it should not be compromised and it cannot be compromised, but there must be any warning signals where service delivery is compromised, either because people are not doing their job because they're scared of auditors or they're simply being incompetent, or et cetera, et cetera. So, Chair, I think those are the issues that are critical. But coming back to the point around the cooperation with the Monitoring and Evaluation Ministry, indeed, there are ongoing discussions with the Ministry to find ways in which our reports and our emphasis in terms of what should be considered can be taken seriously. It is one avenue, it's not the only avenue, because our leadership visibility program is not only about that unit, but it's about proactively engaging with leadership at all spheres of government, vertically and horizontally. By horizontal, I mean national, provincial, and local government. I suppose vertically is basically ministry by ministry, or department by department, or municipality by municipality, so that we cover it holistically. So that by the time we talk to the coordinating units, at least we know what's happening at a micro level. We're not generalizing, but we can relate to specifics. And relating to specifics, I mean, I can give you a specific example. I mean, we've been to a lot of municipalities. If I can make a municipal example, where the municipalities, including the executive, may prize themselves for complying with the right prescripts but achieving service delivery. And examples, for instance, of municipalities like those, we can give to you. We can visit them. We can engage with the executive mayor. they are more than willing to boast about the fact that there's no contradiction between clean governance and service delivery. But you go to another municipality to get it, sometimes a totally different mindset, where clean governance is perhaps seen as a bit of an obstacle to service delivery. But you go to another municipality once again where they say, you see here we actually have got good audit reports, but the attention we're getting is less than those that are the culprits that have got disclaimers. Why are there these contradictions? Because now it makes us to doubt whether what we're doing is worth doing. Because those that are constantly getting disclaimers are getting more attention in terms of funding, in terms of whatever, in terms of their service delivery priorities, and we don't. You know, so there are all sorts of contradictions there. Exactly, yeah. So in a nutshell, I think we do have examples that there's no contradiction between clean governance and service delivery. Where it happens is because people want to make that an issue, and there's no justification, and there can never be a justification for that.
I suppose at some point you'll tell us by when we need to go through formally the process of approving the standards, as well as the other matter of the that we dealt with the, first of the approving what is it? The tariffs, yes. I can just mention to colleagues that I had a little chat over lunch with REMCO to also discuss REMCO's processes around the fixing of salaries of the AG's office, DAG, and so on, and to look at the appropriate structure that should apply going forward. I suppose one will need to make sure that there's absolute certainty as to what the decision making process should be like, so that when we finalize that, it's all in accordance with the governance framework in terms of what does the chair of SCOAC's role entail vis-a-vis REMCO, and what should the nature of that consultation actually be. I've already expressed my own views informally at this stage in terms of the way they are thinking, in terms of the approach in that regard, which I find to be very balanced and fair in terms of some of the arguments they're putting forward. But I suppose in due course, one would then invite REMCO back to the full committee to give some kind of report once the process is finalized. We're still with the two reports. The latter and the last report being the one on audit standards, which was presented immediately before lunch. Colleagues, are there any further issues that you want to raise in this regard? There was a matter that arose in our interaction. I cannot recall whether it was at our first meeting or even prior to that when I was interacting with the AG's office. And that relates to the levels of compliance and the levels of penalties having to be commensurate to the levels of compliance. There was a time here in Parliament where there was a suggestion by the former Speaker, Preni Dinyala, that we should introduce sanctions for members for non-attendance in meetings and in the House and the issuers? Do you deal with it on the basis of no work, no pay? Or do you deal with it as a violation and, you know, stagger the severity of penalties according to how frequent the person violates? But the kind of criteria, I don't know, at what point would you want us to engage around, you know, these different categories? Qualified reports, what are the other categories? Disclaimers, so on, and the rank of or degree of severity linked to the degree of sanction, whatever the appropriate model of sanctions would be, etc. At what point do we get to engage with those issues? And what work has been done thus far in developing a system there?
Chair, I think that would be very welcome engagement with SCOWEC. At the moment, we are doing some research within the office, which we will, once we've found a few thoughts or established a few thoughts around it, share with SCOWEC. But the view is also shared with the ministry of monitoring and evaluation. So that what gets done about it can then be applied from that platform. Because at the moment there is nothing that is that formal other than the performance evaluation system that is applied by the Public Service Administration and or Public Service Commission, which is part of the broad performance evaluation mechanism by government. I would imagine the intention here is how these thoughts can fit into that system. Why I'm saying that is because one of the sources of frustrations when we briefed cabinet last year was the fact that some of the glaring areas of non-performance by departments or accounting officers tend to relate to the fact that some of these audit results are not necessarily in line with their expectations. And when they apply sanctions as ministers, these sanctions tend to be contradicted, legitimately so, by the Public Service Commission, because it's in conflict with some of the parameters that have been applied in terms of the weighting and evaluation of the department officials. That matter became, I didn't understand then when the ministers were highlighting the need to evaluate this same issue. But when I went to one province, I can't remember, I think it was Northern Cape, the premier there also re-emphasized this point, that no matter what you do, as long as the weighting of financial performance in the performance contract of financial of accounting officers is still 5%, we'll never win this battle. Because whether I've got a disclaimer of opinion, whether I've got a bad report, 5% is a minuscule weighting to influence the performance of an accounting officer. And this issue needs to be addressed at that level as well. So whatever we do, we need to think around the holistic model of performance evaluation in the entire public service. Yeah. So I think that's the thinking that is happening at this stage here. But we cannot be the ultimate custodians or the ultimate authors of that system. We can only make inputs based on our own experience.
It does seem that at some point we'll need to interact with the Public Service Commission because apart from this specific issue, they perform an evaluation themselves and they issue reports. I suppose those reports go to the relevant portfolio committee, but to the extent that they impact on the various departments, I mean the various portfolio committees' work, I don't know whether they are taken up, their recommendations and findings are dealt with, and there's as much fanfare around their reports as there is around the AG's report, because I don't know if they served before SCOPA, and I don't know if SCOPA is officially expected to be the body that deals with them, department by department. But also just in terms of the synergy between what Public Service Commission does, as you said, and what the AG's office does, I think those are some of the things we may need more clarity. So maybe we may need to look at our program and see how best to structure a briefing session where we would have a joint presentation somehow between Public Service Commission and yourself around some of these issues, including the vexed issue of teeth and enforcement. Because the one question that's constantly arisen is that you can talk of the AG reporting to Parliament, SCOPA being Parliament's arm to actually haul people on the red carpet. Who follows up after that? What if, who is actually responsible to ensure that enforcement post-Parliament actually happens? Because I know in Parliament, having been a House, I almost said housewife, but having been a House whip at some point, my other job was to look at what comes before the House. Is it in the form of a resolution? Are we going to adopt the report? Are we going to note the report? But after the report has been adopted with a set of findings and recommendations from SCOPA or any portfolio committee, that requires the executive to follow on certain things, to take certain actions. Who then must take responsibility of monitoring that actually happens? So we may need to have, I know at the level of chairs, we've had a workshop, we touched on that. But I think as SCOIC, obviously we do take an interest, a keen interest in ensuring that the work of the AG finds its natural conclusion, which is that where wrongs need to be corrected, the system is responsive enough to ensure that that actually happens. But I think it's enough for a day. We've received a lot of information which is food for thought that we need to go and digest and reflect on, and we'll look at programmatically what does it mean, what future meetings, engagements, others need to be planned to take this work and this processes forward. Certain things require our decision as going. I suspect that somebody is telling me that we've long past 3 o'clock, which I have to be our date time frame. All right. AG, your closing remarks before I release this very dedicated workaholics who work on Friday afternoon when everybody else is busy elsewhere.
Just quickly, Chair, in terms of the two interventions that you have asked for guidance on, in terms of the approvals that SCOWEC needs to do on the two presentations today, when we present the strategic plan, the date of which is to be perhaps arranged between our respective offices, that's the time that SCOWEC would be expected to consider the tariff and also the directive for the audit standards. Fortunately, we will do our presentation on that day, and SCOREX still has another 2 months in terms of the Public Audit Act to digest information and then make a determination on those issues.
Parliament's own program. All of this is supposed to happen before the end of this year. All right. So as long as we know the parameters, then we'll have to plan backwards. The annual report, would it have to come before the strategic plan, I suppose, logically. All right. So we'll just go and revisit the program in the light of the deliberations today and recommend a revision of the program accordingly and come back to the committee. But thank you very much. Unless there's other pressing matters that we need to take note of. Yes.
Covered one. The second issue is the release of the general report or the consolidated PFMA results for 2008-2009. We have received a date from the committee of chairs, the chairs of that committee, of that grouping, the 8th of October between 2 and 4 will be the slot that we've been given to present the results of 2008-2009. It will be the first presentation that we'll do before we go to the provinces. And it to be the first public presentation. Yeah.
Would it be before the House, before the chair, the Committee of Chairs, or would it be before SCOPA? What would be the forum?
It to be the Chairs of Chairs. The forum similar to the one we held in last time.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
What you don't know is whether all the members of SCOWEC will be invited there. Otherwise, we may need to arrange a separate session to brief SCOWEC.
All right, I think we just note that we need to investigate that with the Chair of Chairs and get clear guidance on that. And, of course, there's an APEC workshop that's coming up, 27th to the 29th, to the 30th, at the Convention Center. So we expect all of you there. All arrangements, I understand, have been made by the committee section for members. Other than that, is there any other business? I always have to juggle my memory between the many institutions that I'm involved in and the dates and so on, because I'm also on the Magistrates Commission and serving in several committees there. But, is there anything else before I adjourn the meeting? Thank you very much. So we're going on recess next. We're going on recess for about 2 weeks or so, I think, starting from the 22nd until the 8th of October, on which day we actually have a meeting scheduled. What day is it? Is it the 9th? What day of the week is it? It's a Friday. Is that whole week a committee week?
Yes.
All right. So, which means that week starts on, we're resuming on the 4th.
Yeah,
whatever.